Good evening, everyone. As I said earlier, Roshi couldn't come today. Her husband has been diagnosed with COVID, and she doesn't feel well herself. She sent me a message late this afternoon, and she said, "Can you take over?" So I said yes. It kind of changed my plans, even though it didn't really change my plans, but I wasn't expecting to talk. So I noticed as soon as I realized that I would have to talk, my mind started to be like, what am I going to talk about? What do I want to share? The irony of it is that I don't have any work right now with the agencies, communication agencies I work with normally. And I spend a lot of time reading, mostly Buddhist books or Buddhist related topics. And nothing really just came out of my mind thinking, oh yeah, this is what I want to talk about. It's really nice to gather once again. Yesterday, so our president announced that again we are entering in sort of semi-confinement mode, not being able to go out between 9 p.m. until 6 a.m. So that means and not having huge crowds of friends at home and not going to restaurants, and so that's part of not going to theaters, movies. For me, it's not going to change much because I wasn't going out much these days. Using that time really just to enjoy myself at home, reading, thinking, practicing. It's a very unusual time. We've said that so many times, and it's changing every single day. Also, things evolving. It really puts us in a very in the heart of this impermanence that we keep talking about. It really pulls the rug out of our feet. Difficult to make any plans. Difficult also to entertain ourselves the way we used to entertain ourselves also. And I personally also noticed that I switched to different entertainments, but the tendency to the inclination of the mind to be entertained is very present, I find, for me. Even sometimes I notice how, reading can be also, reading, learning, studying can be a sometimes a way to entertain myself. Sometimes it's a way to, most of the time, I hope. I mean, or it's also, I would say, a way to deepen my understanding. But there is also in there, I mentioned that last week, there is also an element for me of clinging, of craving, just like get more, get better understanding, get a better knowledge. And what's has struck me recently, studying all these texts and going from old texts of the Pali Canon, the literature, the old literature, Buddhist literature, and the Zen literature, is that there's a lot, a huge amount of books and huge amount of canonical literature. And at the same time, it points to something very simple, basic, that really can be reduced to really no word or one word or just thusness, this is just it. Or, and we have all this literature to express that. And yeah, it was mentioned many times that at the same time we have all these sutras, and at the same time, really just saying the first syllable of the Heart Sutra is enough, in the sense that are we able to just be there, just there at that moment, just present to whatever is. And I was just before sitting, I was looking at the one of the collection of the koans that we study, and I was looking at the cases, and it was like, yeah, it's always about the same thing. It's like one guy asking to someone else, what, asking a question, and just testing his ability to whether or not to be just really present. Is he in his mind and in his concept, or is he just, or is that person just really present to what is? And we can expound immensely that experience and talk about it and see all the ramifications of it. One of the texts I've looked at this week, and I thought maybe it just I that is a one of the oldest texts of our tradition. It's the Avatamsaka Sutra, and there are a few quotes that I had written down, and I really I maybe the that really inspired me, and I thought maybe I could share that with you. And see how that unfolds. The Avatamsaka is one of the oldest, and the language is very flowery and very. So, if we go beyond that, there's certain things that I find that are really beautiful, and that really spoke to me. Just a few quotes that I'd like to share that I'd like to share with you. First one is, in each of the Buddha's pores sit Buddhas, many as atoms in all lands, surrounded by masses of enlightened beings, expounding the supreme practice of the universally good. And that really struck me, the expounding the supreme practice of the universally good.
Do you read again, please?
Yes. In each of the Buddha's pores sit Buddhas, many as atoms in all lands, surrounded by masses of enlightened beings. Well, this is not really important, but it's like we sit as Buddhas, we sit as human beings, and what do? Expounding the supreme practice of the universally good. And I read that, I was really, it really struck me how really going back to what I keep going back to, it's like our intention when we sit, what do? What do we try to practice? So one of the expounding notion that we could add with this thusness, just being present is also being present, but really being present with that, with a certain practice, with a certain intention of practicing the universally good, whatever that means, without going into, you know, the right and wrong. It's like universally, and what is universal? Is there something universal? But that, and this is what's embedded into the vow of the vow we recite, the first vow. I vow sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them all, to serve them, or different translations, to be at the service of, to serve, and to be in being relationally exposed to others in with that notion of goodness, with that notion, with that intention of serving, of doing good. That's something that I find is useful to look at for ourselves. Are we practicing just for our own good, which is always a good start? Or do we also, can we expend that? Can we expend the benefaction of our practice? There's a second paragraph that I've really inspired me. In the congregations of all the Buddhas, enlightened beings of supreme knowledge sit, each hearing the teaching, conceiving joy, cultivating themselves in every situation for boundless ages. Each hearing the teaching, conceiving joy, cultivating themselves in every situation for boundless ages. I was struck by the conceiving joy also. That's another element that I find very interesting. There's the notion of good and that notion of joy. And I don't know if you share that, but like if we think about Zen sometimes, if we haven't practiced Zen, or we imagine what people think about what the Zen practice is, it seems very austere, very rigorous, very tough. In the koans, some teachers beat the students. It's like, where's the love there? It's not obvious straight away. And there is an element certainly that introducing the joy in our practice, it can start by the friendliness towards ourselves, the friendliness towards others. But I feel that it's a good indicator of where our practice is, what kind of, do we feel the joy within us? Is there something flourishing that is linked to that joy, that something opens up and again, if we go back to that notion of thusness, if we are able to just not be caught up with ideas, opinions, it's much easier to just enjoy what's there. If we walk around the street, if we are in a house, just doing nothing special, just appreciate it as famous saying of Maizumi Roshi, appreciate your life. And in this appreciation, there is joy involved, I feel. And cultivating themselves in every situation for boundless ages. And I think that in every situation, God, we have very strange, we encounter very strange situations these days. And I keep asking myself, how do I practice with that? That's something that is thrown to us. And how do I practice with that new situation? Another paragraph that inspired me. They are part of this. It's book two of the Avatamsaka Sutra, but they're not. They're just bits and pieces that I give you that really inspire me. In each hair pore are webs of light pervading all quarters, intoning the sublime voices of Buddha, taming the hard to tame. Taming the hard to tame. Taming, is that word, taming, when you have a wild animal and you're taming it so that it becomes more, less wild. Yeah. Or befriending also could be another word, not exactly the same meaning, but something like that. And so there's always, it's a recurrent notion in the sutras, taming the mind. We have that, the figures with the ox and ox representing the mind, and how we try to train the mind, in order to befriend the mind, to make it calmer, so that we're not enslaved by our mind. We're able to master it, to tame it, and we're taming the heart to tame. It's not that easy, and we keep getting caught up all the time, and it's always something to. There's always something to work on, always something to tame. It's never finished. And it's never finished also because every situation is different. And because every situation is different, we might get caught up again. And so, the taming of the mind is what we do, by our training. One of the things that I've read also today is this week is the also the training, viewing the training of the mind it's not just meditation. Meditation is one part of one element of the training. Another element are the rituals. Third element could be studies of Buddhist texts. And the fourth element, which for all of us, it's most of our lives, are our activities, our bodhisattva activities. I mean, anything that we do during the day can be part of that training. And working with people, that's part of our Buddha activities, that's part of our Samu. I mean, we can take it as a bodhisattva activity. Being in a relationship is a hard work. There's a lot to, being in any relationship with friends, if you have a partner, it's also, I find, that's a big work. That's also, that gives all kinds of, gives us all kinds of opportunities to practice, to see where we are in our practice, in our ability to be present to the moment. I find it's an enormous opportunity. And to help us in that, sometimes when we feel a little bit at lost, we can fall back on the precepts, we can fall back on the paramitas, the virtues that we're trying to cultivate in order to inspire. I've said that many times during the day. I'm really going back to the precepts when I feel I'm losing track of what I'm doing or how I'm doing it. Going back to the precepts, that sometimes is really inspiring. It really just, it helps me to focus. It helps me to keep focused. And the last quote that I wrote down, that also going, that goes back to this notion of every situation. It says, the bodies of all Buddhas all have infinite forms. Though their manifestations be innumerable, their forms are never exhausted. The teaching takes many forms. We take many forms. The situations take many forms. And how do we respond to that? With joy? With mindfulness? With a sense of service or of good? And yeah, we sing reality is boundless, or the dharmas are boundless in a different translation. The dharmas being, in a very limited sense, the teachings, but also all phenomena. So this is why we translate that by reality. Reality is boundless, and I vow to see it, or I vow to perceive it. It takes many forms. The manifestations are innumerable, and their forms are never exhausted. I find that very inspiring, because also it reminds me of that notion of not picking. There are certain situations that we dislike for good reasons, some situations that we like for good reasons, or for reasons we're very attached to. And if we, what happens if we stop choosing and picking? What happens if we can see every possible situation that occurs as a possibility to deepen our understanding and to live in a more, with more spaciousness, more freely. I was about what, 10 days ago, I got terrible, terrible back pains. I had never experienced that. I got an injection of morphine and then I was on opium. So I couldn't move at all for a couple of days. The pain was terrible. Certainly it was not something that I liked. But this was the reality. And I had totally to surrender to my wife, to Delphine. I couldn't do anything. I had to accept that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't stand on my feet. I couldn't prepare food. I couldn't help her with anything. I was helpless. So I had to accept that. I had to accept the pain. Then when the pain decreased, I was fearing to be exposed to that level of pain again. So, and I was witnessing that fear coming up. I mean, all these things happened, and I was really trying to use that as practice. So forms are never exhausted. Yeah, I think that's all I think for the moment. This is what I, this is the things that inspired me this week that I'm sharing with you. I don't know if that echoes anything in you, or I open up to discussions and reflections and questions and yeah, Juan.
Good evening. I was particularly struck by the possibilities are endless for practice. And yes, the vow that we sing, reality is boundless, I vow to see it. Sometimes in the morning, when we do zazen, sometimes Dale is present, and I've asked him a couple of times to I asked if someone wanted to say the vows, and he has done it sometimes, but he says, because he knows by heart, a slightly different version. And the third one, which I always think it's really good to hear different versions. I always found it's very interesting. It's very helpful. And the third one is, he says, the dharmas are boundless, if I'm not mistaken. And I was really struck by that, because I've always looked at the third vow, reality is boundless. I've been saying it and thinking about it for the 10 years almost, like that. And the dharmas are boundless. That really that really changed things for me. But this thing with the infinite possibilities of practice, each moment, each activity, each person that we meet, each thought that we have, each emotion that we feel, everything, each thing that we don't realize at the moment, and we realize or don't realize later or a second after, absolutely everything is endless. It's really endless. And the interesting thing is, when I get to the point where running away or not wanting to see something or not facing something doesn't work anymore. It's nowadays I find myself very often in that situation where, you know, it's just, it's impossible to, for some reason it becomes impossible to run away. And actually that makes it so simple. And I'm not just talking about, you know, pleasant stuff. I'm talking about a lot of hard stuff, difficult things, unpleasant things, hard work. But it's very, I always have this very clear feeling that there's no running away from it.
Yeah, I think there's no running away from it, from reality. And the experience that we can have of reality can be very different depending on our intentions. If we have intentions at all. I mean, we probably do have, even when we don't formulate them. So this is why it's always good to, I find it very useful to always, you know, when we say, oh, everything is practice. Again, the practice of what? Because that makes all the difference. The practice of what? Because you can just, you know, just practice mindfulness in order for you to be more productive in your work, and to make more money in order to, you know, that could be your practice. Or the classic example would be just learning how to shoot. You practice mindfulness, but you practice in order to be a better killer. What is it exactly that we do? So the practice of what? And this is why I was this thing of universally good, the intention of, or the intention of serving, or whatever the, or you know, to the precepts, the or taking refuge, or I mean, all these manifestations of our deepest intentions give us the kind of the path that we want to walk, that we want to walk on. And it's a very specific path. And in that sense, I mean, we are picking something, but we're picking something that is a path of, we don't know what it's going to look like. Also, we don't know what the shape of it, but we do know what we want to walk on, what we want to cultivate. And I think it's good to be clear on that.
That's actually very, very helpful. Because it's like, lots of times it's like, I'm not even sure if I asked the question to myself, but it's like I was asking. It's like I could ask, and the practice could be, I was thinking, I was hearing you, what you were saying, and I was thinking, the practice of not running away. what am I cultivating, or what am I? And it could be just this, it's just the practice of not running away, which is not, it's important, of course, but sometimes it's like I can ask myself the question, so it's just this, that's the whole point. And so when you say something like, when you bring this thing with the intention, I feel that's like the way to go. Like that's one step further from this situation where I see myself many times of, you know, it's just this, it's just not running away. It's just, so in thinking the intention.
Yeah.
It's like one step further, let's.
Yeah, and I think it also, I find it very useful personally to notice that also when I say this, like, you know, what's the practice? What are we practicing? The forms are plural. We have different, at certain times, it's very difficult to be at the surface of, to just feel that, we are capable of serving someone. This is maybe not appropriate, but we are may able to cultivate another aspect, even though, ultimately boils down to the same, but like the form it takes can be very different. I mean, we practice meditation. Sometimes we practice koan. If we practice koan, it's certain type of practice. Sometimes we practice just shikantaza or just following the breath, the different practices. We might do a practice of compassion. I was struck. I just finished reading the book from Mingyo, what's in French, it's called Pour tout l'amour du monde. The English title is, I don't know, it's like this Tibetan monk that had a monastery and all that, and he left for a couple of years and went in the street. And so he explains, the Tibetans are really good for that. He explains all the various practices that he does, depending on the situation. And reality comes, a situation comes, and that's your practice. Sometimes you have an argument with your partner. Well, there's that really, you know, points to a certain practice that you can, or certain aspect of the practice. different situation. You're walking in the street, maybe just walking, you know, being mindful with the sensations, and that may be something totally different, you know. And we can play with that, and I find that really really fascinating. Two days ago I had to have a scan, so I went into, for the first time in my life, on this, in this machine, and so with the sound, and they gave me the helmet and all that, and I was like, all right. And I thought, oh, that's quite, I was kind of scared to have a feeling of claustrophobia in there. So I started to do a body scan, actually, see how it feels, and, you know, being mindful of that situation, being mindful of my fear of, oh, if I open my eyes and I'm going to see that very closed, you know, environment, I'm going to freak out. So I was paying attention to that too. So at that moment, it wasn't about, you know, compassion to others. It was just like, okay, let's become acquainted with that particular situation, and that was almost scary to me. So looking at that from that perspective, also, you know, the many situations that we encounter is also the possibility of practice, but the possibility of practicing different things depending on different situations also. Yeah. I mean, Debbie mentions so many times her encounters in the public transport, you know. This is very specific, you know. It's like each time, you know, it's like, okay. And every time, I'm sure you would confirm that, it's slightly different also. And it pulls certain triggers each time that is also very interesting. How do I react? Well, maybe it's not going to be the same as last time. And the situation is certainly different. Sometimes it's the noise, sometimes it's the smell, sometimes it's the train running late, and it goes, you know, all kinds of things, all kinds of situations. That's very rich. And so this is why that word Dhamma, that is at the same time all phenomenon, therefore reality, but also the teachings. It's awesome. That's an awesome word. We use that in a limited sense, the teachings, or even more limited, like the sutras, like, yeah, the teachings of the Buddha. And at the same time, wow, it's all phenomenon. Yeah, Debbie?
Well, you set me up. When I was thinking, when you were talking, first of all, thank you for that, what you just said about what Dharma means, because I have a problem with this word. Every time I ask somebody what it means, they say, oh, it means a lot of things, but that's not really an answer. So now I'm getting I have more of an idea of what we're talking about. When I was thinking, when you were talking about the joyous aspect of, despite Zen's black robes and everybody being silent and everything, my feeling is that since I am no longer mad on the train, I'm having a good time. Mm. When anger, greed, and ignorance start to alleviate, then you're, honestly, the first time I had an encounter with somebody who was pushing me and I wasn't mad, I was filled with joy. I've been mad all my life. This was the first time in my life that I didn't want to turn around and punch the guy in the face. It was a very, I felt like saying, thank you, sir. That was really transcendent. It was a very joyous moment. It's kind of, now I'm getting used to it. I'm going to have to find something else to do. Seriously, because now it's kind of like, oh, I'm not mad. And I think, oh, that's kind of old. But not being mad is a source of enormous joy to me this year, really. Yep. So I assume that as other deficiencies or whatever they're called, character traits or whatever, negative character traits, alleviate, there is more joy. And also the desire to be nice to people. At least in my case. Because I'm not mad at them anymore.
Yeah, thank you. That's wonderful. Yeah, that's really wonderful. Wonderful explanation, illustrations. How our relationship to reality can be transformed by our work, and our work of dropping our ideas, judgments, and all that. Another mind-blowing discovery that I've encountered recently. We keep talking about suffering in Buddhism, the first noble truth. Life is suffering, and it's quite a statement. I won't go into the details of it, but what really I was reading Stephen Batchelor and looking back and forth between his books and the sutras, and what he says is that, I mean, I looked at the sutras, it's exactly what he says. It's not that life is suffering. The word dukkha that is being translated as suffering, anxiety, or something like that, it's in the sutras, very specific definitions are given. It's like old age, death, wanting things that you can't have, not wanting things that happens to you, our relationship, what happens with our body and all that. More or less, it's the whole existence, your whole experiential, what you experience in life. So life is, being born, dying, going into the subway. It's like all those phenomena and what happens within us. And that really transforms our understand. I mean, that broadens our perspective also, that life is all that. So like the first task with the noble truth is embrace life, embrace life. And it's not actually maybe the idea that it's like, okay, we start with that notion of suffering. It's like all kinds of things, difficult things, but also joyful things. So we need to embrace that. That's what Stephen Batchelor calls the first task, embrace life. This is how we translate that first noble truth as embracing life. And maybe if we start with that perspective instead of thinking, okay, first thing is life sucks and life is suffering. it's a very different starting point than to say, life is, okay, we could say life is rich. Life is rich with all kinds of experiences. Some are painful, some are what they are, and let's see how we work out in our relationship with reality. Lisa.
Sorry, first of all, for turning off the camera on and off. I have a bad connection. I just wanted to say thank you, and what Jean said in reaction to commenting on what you were saying, Jean, about there's no running away. I had something of the sort coming up as well, and so that's about seeing. So, but then I was also thinking, and that's maybe related to what W just said also about anger, and how do you, so when there's no running away, that you're seeing what is, and sometimes what is isn't, you see that you're this sloth and torpor, There's ignorance, there's anger, you see it. And you embrace it, even if it's not necessarily what you would want to experience or the state you'd want to be in. And that's not always easy, just being with it.
Yeah. It's not. I think Debbie can testify with the fact that she struggled for many years with the subway situation. Yeah, it's the painful, being annoyed, and it and then it gets transformed eventually. I mean, eventually, if we want it to, the running away can. I guess I see it. Like there are two aspects. There is no running away in the sense that reality is always going to be what it is. However, the our relation to reality, sometimes we try to run away to that, not seeing it. But the vow that we make is, I vow to see it. Sometimes we fail to see it. Sometimes we're not very good at responding to it. Sometimes we're not very good at we observe that the letting go is not really happening the way we thought it should happen. But we have a clear intention to see it. We have a clear intention to work with that material that reality is, that reality offers to us, that the reality that we encounter, and we want to work with that. But we don't, you know, some people don't want to. And that's their right, you know, but the experience is very different. This is what I think all of us can testify by noticing how things evolved with a practice. And yeah, I find joy is definitely quite an indicator of how our relationship to others and reality is being transformed. How do we function? Do we function more freely or not? That free functioning is an idea that a concept that I really like. Free functioning. We function freely in the world, more freely. Maria asked the question, so how can we take our practice to others? Does it just happen as a side effect of our own individual practice? Maria, what do you mean by your practice to others? You mean, how do we share that?
Hi. Yeah,
hi.
You said something about when you were talking earlier. You said something about taking the practice to others, yeah, as a service, or I suppose that's why I'm asking. I really didn't understand.
What? Yeah, the vow. I mean, like the first vow is sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Or different translation that are being used, that is being used, is to serve them. And I keep going back to that when Juan last year received transmission from Gena Roshi. It really, really struck me. All the teachers were basically saying, I'm here to serve. I keep also going back to my personal memory where I had an interview with Roshi and we were discussing about the center here in Paris when we still had the center. And I said, you know, I have my preferences, but you know, I'll, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'm at your service. And she said, I am at your service. And obviously she was, because she was there for me to help me in that, on that, on my path. And I find that for me, that in a way, I mean, if we really keep our vows, it happens. The way it happens, we don't really know. The danger for me is that when we really want to be at the service of someone, it's like, it's me wanting to be at the service. I want to help. And then we get into trouble, because the way it turns out, the outcome is not necessarily what we expected. We might be disappointed. We do that for the wrong reasons. We do that to fulfill a need. You know, we want to be appreciated. I don't know, all kinds of trap there. So it's interesting to look at that too, I find. What happens when we say that I want to serve? What exactly is at stake there? But I, you know, I feel that there's probably it comes with that practice of being present to oneself, but also to open up. We open up, and then I think there's something very organic. We just want to share. We just want to serve. It's very, I mean, I go very quite often now to Montreuil to do my Kesa, the robe for next year, and Juan is helping me, Juan Rodriguez, who received transmission last year, and he's helping me, and he's really just, that's his job. I mean, that's what he wants to do, just like help. And I don't think it's something that, or if you're a parent and you're raising your kids, it's, there's something organic that flows, that it's not even like doesn't seem like it's a decision that we're trying to stick to. You know, there's something natural about it.
That openness, that it comes naturally, I suppose, also with praxis.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a, I mean, that's my experience. Yeah. And also my experience is also sometimes being caught up with too much of an, I want to do, you know, what am I going to be able to do? What am I going to be able to do? what do they need? You know, and then I become too self-involved, you know, and not really paying attention to, okay, they're, what's the situation there? So again, reality is boundless. I vow to see it. What's the need?
Thank you.
Just, I'll finish with that. I remember, when was it? Two summers ago at the transmission retreat, I was Roshi's Jisha. And my mother had died just in that couple of weeks before. So I was a little bit off. I was self-involved in my grief. And I really had difficulties to see her needs. And I could see that there was another Jisha who was one step ahead of me each time. He was like bringing the cup of water or whatever before the teacher even asked. And I was totally out of my mind. And it was like, Oh yeah, and she had really to ask for things, and even when she asked, I could forget or something. You know, I wasn't very present, and I realized that afterwards. On the moment, I really didn't see it, but that was part also of my process of seeing what reality is and where I was, and paying attention to where I was. All right. Well, thank you for all this sharing. We'll finish with the vows. Juan, you want to chant the vows?
Juan, can I ask that we dedicate this talk and the sitting to Roshi Emi?
Yes, absolutely. Let's do that. Yeah. Thank you.